Hello, hello.
Hello, nice art behind you.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. Fortunate to be in a predominantly black art space here in Oakland.
Mm-hmm. Nice.
Yeah.
Is it windy over there?
It's not too bad. Yeah, it's not too bad.
It's been windy.
The city?
Very windy.
Yeah. Hello, hello, Hannah.
Hi, how are you?
Doing well. How are you?
I'm good. I'm good. Nice to see you.
Good to see you too.
Hi, Chuck.
Hey, how are you?
Good. How are you doing?
I'm doing okay. I'd rather get back to real meetings.
I know. In person.
Yes.
I feel you, yeah.
This is a lot easier, so.
It's true, yeah. Cuts down on all that travel time.
Chuck, your hair is so long.
Hey, this is
COVID luxurious.
Hair. COVID hair for real.
You and Hannah are going to be in like a hair off.
Yes.
A so hair battle.
This is 13 months.
Oh, really?
Yes.
13 months without a haircut.
Yes.
I don't know. Wow.
I don't know either.
Mark, you seem to have been maintaining your hairstyle this whole time. What's your secret? You Flo-by? You cut it yourself?
In the first half, I cut it myself, and I did a pretty good job as long as you didn't see me from behind. It was apparently horrible. Sure. And then when barbershops reopened, I was definitely there for sure. Because my hair would just grow into this gigantic dark Q-tip shape if I didn't. It just goes up.
Look what I walk in on.
Hair trauma, Stephen. Hair trauma. Pandemic-related hair trauma.
I can relate. Yeah.
But I'm lucky with a nice full head of hair that, so I shouldn't complain, right? At 50 years of age, I'm going to be thankful for the small favors.
I'm like, yeah, I haven't cut my hair in 13 months either.
It looks great though. Love it.
That's not true. I cut it every day.
Oh, yeah. Well, Chuck and David, I don't know who's facilitating this meeting, but it looks like...
I'll do it.
We have one, two, three. Well, I don't know if we have quorum quite yet. Do you know, Valerie, if there's any excused absences?
Juba. Juba.
Okay, well, if Juba's excused, then we should have it. You could start whenever either of you'd like to start.
Okay, then can you just run through the introductions real fast? Ask everybody to say hello.
Sure thing. If you could introduce yourselves, council members, start with you, Chuck.
Chuck Adams, co-chair of this committee.
David?
David Gonzalez, co-chair of this meeting and community co-chair of the council.
And we'll do our two committee members present. Matt? Or three.
Ed Geldmaker, council member.
Jack?
Jackson Bowman, council member.
Irma?
Irma Parada, council member and council co-chair.
Right, and then we'll do council staff. Mark Molnar, council staff. Valerie?
Valerie Itakudo, council staff. And I just want to, sorry, I just wanted to make a note that Juba isn't on this committee, so.
Okay, yeah. Well, let's still consider this as achieving quorum. We don't really have any votes this this meeting anyway.
And Ken Pierce said he's stuck in traffic. He'll be on in a little bit.
Okay, so let's go with our guests and slash members of the public. Hannah?
I am Hannah Yord. I'm with the Community Health Equity and Promotion Branch of Department of Public Health.
Thank you. Angel?
Good afternoon, everyone. My name is Angel Fabian. I am with IMPACT, Global Action for Gay Men's Health and Rights, with the Fíjate Bien program.
Thank you. Stephen?
Good afternoon, Stephen Spano, the AGCAP staff attorney at ALRP.
Right, I'll go ahead and share screen so we can look at the agenda. So we'll see here, we have mainly two presentations to take a look at. We're gonna hope that our guests will be able to share their screen and walk us through it. And for those who haven't done a presentation review before, you can definitely use broad strokes. No need to go into too much detail since this will be going for the full council anyway. And then after those two, we'll do a bit of a work plan update, look at some suggestions that came from our last, from the evaluation survey before last.
We need to review the agenda.
Yep, that's what's on screen now.
Okay, there it is. All right, anybody have any questions about the agenda? If not, then by consensus.
All right, I'll stop share and I'll go to the minutes. Moment. So we'll see here, pro forma in the beginning, then we had a presentation from another ETE grantee. So it's a community health center, Ming Ming came by and there was a lot of discussion and we looked over the work plan as well and rearranged some things.
Are there any questions?
As we see here, we do have quorum because Cicely and Paul, since one is activated for COVID-19 support, the other one is engaged in those efforts, they get automatic excusals. And Antoine, as of this month, is actually no longer a council member. So we've achieved quorum. Wow.
Good.
He's had a step back.
Okay, if there is no changes, we'll approve that by consensus also. So are there any announcements? Small group today. All right, any public comment? No? All right, then Mark, can you pull it up or is Angel going to?
Oh, we're moving right along. We're ahead of schedule. Angel, if you would mind sharing screen.
Thank you, everyone, for allowing me to present some of the major findings on the Latina, Latino, Latinx and Indian epidemics engagement, specifically from our previous partners, Collective Data, Cause Data Collective. And we'll also be sharing some information about one of the innovative strategies or disruptive strategies that we're hoping to implement this year with the use of the secret client methodology. Again, my name is Angel Fabian. I'm the advocacy coordinator with IMPACT, specifically the Fíjate Bien program. What we're hoping to achieve through this session is to become a little bit more familiar with IMPACT, one of the best kept secrets that I say of the Bay Area and the Fíjate Bien program, to review some of the findings from the community engagement piece with the Latinx, Latina, Latino community, and introduce the client methodology and its use with the Latin CAPS this year. So IMPACT it's a rather young organization. It was born in 2006 in the Toronto International AIDS Conference, where activists, organizers, researchers, and the such noticed that there was still not enough attention being placed on where the epidemic was going, specifically its impact around gay and bisexual men, predominantly from the Global South. And so they decided to create an advocacy-run organization, and thus we were born. What differentiates us from other organizations is our willingness to step forward and act to address the lack of HIV responses, specifically impacting gay and bisexual men and, by default, trans communities in some regions of the world through a human rights lens, and also belong to global networks that are advocating for key populations, including sex workers, drug users, and transgender communities and people living with HIV. This is our global reach. This is why I say we're kind of the best kept secret. We've been in Oakland for almost 13 years. And this is our current reach. We work with over 120 community-based organizations across 62 countries. And as you can see, those are some of the countries listed. The Fíjate Bien program was born maybe 2-3 years ago as a result of some of the data that we were seeing on a national scale and by invitation of one of our funders, Beef Healthcare, to address the crisis that was happening among Latinx gay and bisexual men. In the increase in new HIV infections. But not only that, the work that still needed to be done around treatment, access to treatment and care services. So we aim to support community engagement efforts, establish partnerships with key organizations, and provide technical assistance and capacity building, and address systemic barriers to HIV prevention care and treatment faced by Latinx gay and bisexual men in the US and Puerto Rico. So, yes. So as a result of this partnership work that we do nationally, we were able to connect with locally with Jorge Sanchez. And so this work that I'm about to present around the ending the epidemic's Latinx perspective is in memory of the life and work of Jorge Sanchez, whose untimely death last December caused a lot of sorrow among the community that he was very passionate about. So in his memory, we continued with this project. And I'm sharing results from last year and what we're hoping to achieve this year.
The findings were shared with the Ending the Epidemic group in December of 2020. What was developed was a 4-page summary of the 90-page Ending the Epidemic's report in 3 languages, English, Spanish, and Brazilian Portuguese. And it was important to translate between community languages and DPHEs. And more important, 38 community members participated in qualitative interviews with a total of 40 in-depth conversations. So one of the major findings from those conversations were that the Latinx community is it's very, very large and very diverse. And so it would be helpful to subdivide it for targeting messages and services to languages spoken, immigration or migration status, and countries of origin. The fundamental challenge of ending the epidemics and how broad that is in light of all the other challenges that are being faced within the Latinx communities. Some ideas of the disruptive innovations that came up from these groups were, you know, the following, and I won't go into each in detail now, but, you know, I'll make mention in the larger group. But one of the approaches that we suggested to Jorge that we have a lot of experience with is the secret client methodology. Well, I'll go further in this presentation. These major findings were shared with a group, with the Ending the Epidemics group. There was a round two of recommendations. In the round two of the second version of the Ending the Epidemics had these recommendations. And so community folk had the opportunity to respond to some of the recommendations. And so they were really excited. Folks were really excited about the workforce pipeline and added the caveat that that support systems needed to be in place in order for a workforce pipeline to function. This is one of the areas that we are continuing to do some training, workforce development training around for this year. The Leadership Institute, they were really excited about that, as long as it provided a pathway to living wage jobs and opportunities. There was a lot of agreement around outreach and community engagement and the importance of continuing those efforts. And the impact that not only HIV, HCV, and STIs, but also COVID has had in the community. And to ensure that efforts to address mental health from non-crisis care to basic education to trauma-informed care was of interest to several of the group members. The secret client methodology basics that I'm gonna cover is part of several different projects that we have done globally. Place the secret client methodology on community monitoring, and why is it important? Unfortunately, in many parts of the world still, there's pervasive stigma, discrimination, and violence in healthcare settings and in some CBOs that must be documented in order to improve program implementation. Through one of our projects, Project ACT, we used the secret client method to document stigma and discrimination in healthcare settings. I will focus in this presentation around the work that we did with Affirmative Action in Cameroon and Sexual Rights Center in Zimbabwe. Although this methodology has also been used with our partners at Eurasia Coalition on Male Health and in Vietnam or South Asia. So the basics about the secret client methodology, we recruit, train, and empower community members around the methodology. We develop with community standardized tools. And then after the training and the development and the training, we ask community members to go and seek services. and monitor those visits that they monitor what they encounter in those visits. From that, we collect and compile data and in some cases, incidents. And then we provide that feedback back to clinics, CBOs, and health department management to implement changes. So the inputs involved resources for training community members, which, you know, fortunately we have those resources now through the implementation phase of the Ending the Epidemic initiative. Resources for secret client reimbursement and stipends, which come from the same pot. And the anticipated outcomes, we anticipate documented incidents and testimonials of barriers to accessing comprehensive services. We also anticipate increasing understanding of the challenges that highly impacted communities face in health settings and in some cases in CBOs and health departments, and to mobilize community, leading to, in some cases, this intervention has led to increased uptake or increased attendance of services and service-seeking behavior among key populations. Any questions at this point?
Thank you for the presentation and for showing it to us. I think it's really great. I think it flows really well, and I think the information is really good. I have a question, but it's not about the presentation.
Yes.
Were the clinics that had the secret client or mystery shopper type thing, were they mm-hmm. aware that this might happen generally, or was it like totally, was it only the participants who were aware that the clinics were being sort of monitored?
So the short answer is yes. And that is one of the reasons that we had requested for us to present the concept, because one key component, and I'll highlight it further down in the presentation in Zimbabwe, is that MOUs were established with two clinics to make sure that management was on board. And there were no surprises, and it was in the light of, in our terminology, it would be quality assurance, and also in one clinic in particular, there was an opportunity for a committee to be formed to implement some of the findings. We definitely, our intention is not to make anyone uncomfortable spring any surprises on any of the community organizations. And so as we move further down this process, we would love to engage with community-based organizations to get those MOUs. As a result of what happened in Zimbabwe, 29 more clinics decided to adopt MOUs with that particular organization and implement some of those findings as well. Any other questions? If not, let me proceed with some examples, specifically in Cameroon and in Zimbabwe, with my provider, My Health. Some of the results in Cameroon, 40% of clients reported dismissive, derogatory gestures, mimicry, pejorative terms, mocking, and comments on personal appearance. And this was very true with trans clients, were more likely to experience those judgments based on their appearance and verbal violence from everyone that they encounter. And so this also highlighted that it was clinic-wide. It wasn't just a provider. It was registration, orientation, consultation, pharmacy, waiting room. And it was perpetrated by nurses, pharmacists, doctors, security guards, and other patients. As a result of that, they were able to create sensitization trainings for healthcare professionals based on the data findings. four training sessions for healthcare providers and then followed by 10 months of observation detailing 162 visits. Facilities and districts develop corrective action plans, including all staff internal trainings, revised waiting room orientations, and a WhatsApp group for healthcare district directors to have direct access to folks who could actually make some immediate changes in some of what was happening. And a celebration to recognize the commitment made by clinics. In Zimbabwe, delayed dignity is a right denied was the name of the project. And the Sexual Rights Center established, this is where what I had referenced earlier, MOUs with two clinics where secret clients would be visiting, ensuring commitment to receive and use the feedback. A total of 57 gay and bisexual men were surveyed and shared their experience accessing services. The checklist that I had previously mentioned or the evaluation tool was created with community input and distributed to the clinics. So as a result of that, sensitivity training policies for new employees were implemented, posting and welcome signage to openly affirm LGBTQ people and their right to be there were implemented. There's now a weekly clinic at the CBO, which moved forward this project in collaboration with the clinics, and 29 additional neighborhood clinics requested to join the project. Lessons learned from the secret client methodology is that secret clients require substantial training and ongoing support to collect accurate and complete data. Protection for the safety and security of the secret clients must be part of the rollout and ongoing mechanisms of meaningful engagement for community members is very useful in adapting corrective actions along the implementation process. And with that, I will take any additional questions.
Well, seeing as there's no questions on health, thank you very much. It looks like this presentation is about 20 minutes. I'm sure it'll be longer because you'll go into more detail. So we'll look at it as maybe a half hour tops for the presentation itself, and then maybe 10 minutes for Q&A at the end. And I like how you did that in the middle too. That was a nice flow. Do you have any questions for us as far as how this will go?
Jackson had a question.
Oh, sorry. I was waving at the FedEx guy.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Then you'll be getting the Zoom information.
I think Hannah has a question.
Okay.
Yes, could I, a question that I have. So on Helen and I have been talking about the, wanting this to be a collaborative effort and that it's not, this is not going to be a surprise for CBOs, maybe setting up MOUs. So one question I have for this group is, can that be part of the discussion at the council meeting, or would that need to be handled somewhere else? Like, we would love your recommendations and your support in moving this forward.
I think that that would be a great topic for a small group discussion. I don't know if there'll be time on the agenda to have both a discussion of the presentation itself and this fantastic idea, actually. But I'm wondering if the next meeting, what I could do is bring forward the salient points to this, and then we can have that small group discussion on health. Of course, you'd be welcome to join us again if you'd like, or Hannah, of course, always. But either way, I could then forward the results from the discussion and perhaps, move from there? How does that sound as far as incorporating this idea within the Bay Area continuum? Yeah, that works for everyone? Oh, looks like Ken and David.
I'll go first. The next full council meeting I'm facilitating, and I'm already thinking of how to actually frame this presentation before we get into it. And I don't want to overcomplicate it, but at the same time, if we're going to have a conversation, there is that, I think Hannah had developed like really cool visuals on the ETE that describes sort of like the pillars, but really, really sort of also kind of sort of had a good visual of what the community engagement part was supposed to be about, specifically around sort of like being innovative and being able to address, you know, so, you know, really have an inclusion of community voice within the ET moving forward. So if you want, we can use that visual I feel it may be a little too complicated, but if we're going to be doing small breakout groups, it'd be good to have something that go along to introduce that portion of the meeting to really give it context as opposed to just a standalone presentation, more about this is a continuing conversation we've been having with all these other organizations about how we're collaboratively working together across the Bay.
Before we go to Ken, let me respond. Excuse me, I'm coughing a bit. I should be clear, there won't be room for small groups in this month's meeting. So that's us suggesting that it is a continued discussion into next month's meeting with the small groups. And so maybe the visual could appear then, I'm not sure. But we'll need reframing, of course, before those small groups occur if there's a month between.
Ken.
My sense is yes, we need more framing of this before we see it. We need a kind of better introduction on how this impacts us. And as to Hannah's request for us to endorse it, I think it's really awkward for us to be endorsing in front of the participant if we're in a situation where we're saying this is too esoteric or we find whatever the reason. I think you need to give us a little bit of space to kind of think about what this is and how our endorsing it really plays what role in all this. So once again, reinforcing what David said, it's all about framing this introduction to how this works, because I don't think that any of us, whenever we hear kind of a mystery or that some kind of hidden assessment, our big brother ears jump up really quickly. So it's all in about how it's introduced to us and Hannah, how you tell us how this is going to interface and how our endorsement is going to be helpful, but not in a space where we're having to pass judgment in front of somebody right there, because that feels a little awkward. Thank you.
Matt.
So this has to involve SFDPH around any contractual stuff, or maybe I'm missing something, but if people are going to be, I mean, this is all about contracts and service delivery. So I'm not understanding how that's going to be separated out.
I think, though, you could look at it as the contractual part of it, the connecting with the actual service providers, as being something that DPH would handle, of course, because the council doesn't deal with contract management per se. The council deals in broad strokes and best practices, standards of care, and I think the idea could be discussed. Yeah. But not necessarily the micromanaging of like, well, where should this go? Who should they talk to?
That's but I think that's what needs to really be, that needs to be again stressed, because my fear is that we could all of a sudden go down a rabbit hole of kind of, oh, let's name this agency or that agency or different things like that.
Yeah. If I may, one idea that, talking with the consultants that I'm working with this project is to make it optional for organizations to opt in if their interest
and they're interested in being part of this particular pilot, you know, and go from there, specifically if they are receiving additional resources to implement some of the ETE activities this time around.
Yeah, I like the idea. I just think we need to make sure it's wrapped into kind of the contract management that's already happening within SFDPH.
If I could propose, I guess, a structure to how this presentation is framed, because it sounds like there's two kinds of framing that will need to happen. There's an initial framing to remind folks, because people forget that they are now and will continue to hear and see presentations from ETE grantees who are not under the council's purview, but you know, we're an advisory body in some ways. So perhaps if David, as a facilitator, if you could provide that intro to Angel about next you'll see our third presentation from an ETE grantee. And then maybe after Angel has handled the Q&A, if you would mind turning it over to Hannah to perhaps frame, we'd love for the council to discuss this in your next meeting, how you feel about this secret client model and sort of just put it out there, as Ken said, so that people realize, okay, this is something that we should be considering. How does that feel for folks?
That sounds good.
Because I don't necessarily want folks to be automatically looking at Angel's presentation as, what does this mean for the agencies that I'm familiar with? Like, I want folks to actually get this fabulous information about the efforts of this agency that honestly a lot of folks in the council probably are not super familiar with. And so I want that to land. And then I think this part that Hannah said is talking about is an exciting thing and does need that sort of, that, as Ken mentioned, that space of time for people to think about. And then we'll just have to reframe in May as a reminder, okay, we discussed this. And as Hannah mentioned, DPH would love your thoughts on establishing this potentially as part of a potential standard of care if there's buy-in. And then if it's a small group discussion, that also makes it just less chaotic as well. We'll have the facilitators be able to speak to it and remind people what they're specifically doing and talking about, which does not include talking about specific agencies that they'd like to call out.
Just have a question, Matt.
From you.
Yeah, sorry. No, I just need to take down my hand. Sorry.
I can lower your hand for you.
There. Oh.
All right. Well, if that sounds good, Angel, do you have any specific, I guess I'll ask you, Stephen, as well. Do either of you have any specific times that you can't make this 2-hour meeting, or do I have the flexibility to put you kind of where I can on the agenda? It's from 4 to 6.
Yes, no, I booked my schedule is booked for those 2 hours, and also the two consultants that are working with me in this project will be joining me.
Perfect. How about you, Stephen, as long as we're on that topic?
I make myself available to the councils, however.
Love it. Thank you again, Angel.
Thank you, everyone. Bye-bye.
Thank you.
Okay. So is Stephen going to pull his up or?
Yeah, sure, I can do that. I'm trying something new.
Okay.
I'll share a screen.
You can do it. We believe in you.
Right. Cool. So, hopefully one of these years I will get to present in person, but it has yet to happen. So you'll have to deal with me doing this. I hope to today to let everybody know a little bit more about what I do, hopefully increase everyone's knowledge. Everyone on this committee is very familiar with what I do, but I'm sure there will be some new people, including Angel, I hope, is there and sees the presentation. I want to present the work that I did over the last year, and I want to talk with you all about some of the consumers' challenges that I saw throughout the year, which was unique, as well as talk about some of the successes of the program. So HCAP is a program that exists to provide services to consumers of Ryan White Care funded programs, which, as we know, is commingled with the Department of Public Health's HIV Health Services funds. It's a unique program as far as I know. It is the only, San Francisco is the only EMA to fund this service. And in order to qualify for it, it has to be a person living with HIV accessing or trying to access services from one of the HHS services and residing in San Francisco, San Mateo, or Marin counties, which is the EMA. So what are HCAP's goals and services? So I feel like following the last presentation, one of the things that I think is important to note is that I'm it is not an accountability program, although, you know, I mean, what I try to do is advocate on behalf of clients, but it is more directly geared at conflict resolution and keeping clients connected to services. I provide advocacy services, mediation services, and I support clients in navigating the system through referrals. I can also provide support to service providers, technical assistance in the form of helping drafting policies such as confidentiality policies, receiving direct referrals from fellow service providers, and assisting to remove other barriers that might be outside the control of other service providers to help clients access their services. We are at 1663 Mission Street, Suite 500. That's been less relevant this year than it has been in other years, but obviously I'm always available via email and phone. Well, I'll talk a little bit about some of the challenges that posed earlier. Or that posed later. But this year, we had a slight increase. So there were 96 unduplicated clients with a total of 133 HCAP matters during the contract year. That's up almost 7% from last year. There were no cases in San Mateo or Marin counties. I did have a couple of direct referrals coming from San Mateo and Marin, despite my best efforts, wasn't able to actually connect with those clients, and it's unclear as to why that might have happened. But I think there was a lot of issues with clients trying to access services that perhaps I wasn't aware of. There were no massive changes to demographics from last year. You can kind of see here from, there were 58 unduplicated clients over the age of 50. There were no massive changes, to be honest, with regard to any of the demographics that HCAP normally sees. And you can view all of that in greater detail on the HCAP report. One notable number is that is income. And a large percentage of our clients are under $15,000. They're on fixed income in most instances. Top four categories this year, one was primary medical, the second emergency financial assistance. These are not surprising given the events of 2020. Housing issues and case management issues also were top categories for service, for needs for HCAP services. And I can talk a little bit more about why that might have been in just a moment. My services and the top four issues that were presented to me were requiring information and referral, the miscommunications that occurred, problematic policies and procedures, and access issues to services. The responses to those this is something I have to change. So just to note to this committee, the advice and consultation category is 133, and a big part of that is because in every instance I'm providing some sort of consultation. So how I notate that, but I'll exclude that from the next slide. But referrals continues to be among the highest number of services that I render, and mediation upped itself this year. So I can talk a little bit more about that. Grievances filed were two, and agency actions sustained were two. There were other instances where mediation and or asks in some regard were resulted in a change to policies, but they were kind of notated differently. So here, you know, with regard to grievances filed, it was not a preferred method in 2020. And I have another slide talking about that. So this is basically kind of distilling all of this. Based on HCAP cases, housing-related financial emergency financial assistance is one of the greatest needs. In addition, housing services became one of the greatest needs. So it's actually not just the emergency financial assistance related to housing. A lot of times that conflates with case management and housing services. And a lot of that has to do with cohabitation issues. We'll talk more about that. Majority of consumers continue to age consistent with patterns from other presentations. Again, there were no major changes to my demographics this year. And consistent with previous reports, consumers continue to be extremely low income. There was a shift in service categories from previous years. Primary medical up became the highest need, but only by one, and they tend to toggle between one another over the years. If you take a look at the report or the full report, there was also a shift in service categories from previous years. There was also a shift in consumers. That's actually not true. There was a shift toward the least adversarial methods of conflict resolution, meaning the moving more towards mediation and less toward less toward the grievance process, which tends to be a little bit more adversarial. I should note, however, and that's not on this slide, but I would love to add it for the full council, is legal services did increase. So the number of legal service referrals was a large jump. And a big reason for that has to do, I'm sure, with housing insecurity. People not sure exactly how their housing was going to be affected by COVID and by not being able to pay the rent. And so that leads me to this part of the presentation. Some of the unique challenges that were presented in 2020. So housing insecurity, traumas triggered by a new pandemic, uncertainty and fear surrounding everyone's health presented themselves in many ways behaviorally. This occurred in a lot of cohabitation environments, as well as people just living next to one another in apartment buildings. That was kind of shared not only by the consumers, but also by the service providers that operate in a lot of the supportive housing facilities, because how do you manage some of those behaviors while you're also trying to shift to protecting people and protecting yourself as well as a service provider? There were technological barriers that presented themselves this year in ways that hadn't previously presented themselves. But that's actually not true. I want to retract that. They have presented themselves. They just did not present themselves in the same numbers. I think COVID-19 definitely highlighted some of the blind spots that we have with regard to accessing services through technology. And I certainly saw some of those cases in my office. I do want to take a moment because we're in an EMA, or we're geographically, I think we're located in a place where we have the benefit of a lot of experience here, not only on the part of providers, but also on the part of consumers with regard to working through a pandemic, through a public health crisis. And personally, I felt really proud to be in San Francisco because there was a really remarkable level of a resilience exhibited and empathy from both service providers and consumers. AORP and my program HCAP located there obviously encountered some of the same challenges that the service providers throughout the system of care experienced. We did continue to provide services throughout the shelter in place. There were a number of emergency legal issues that we had to manage, wills and POAs, that kind of harkens back to when we started through the HIV crisis, which should give people some context for, you know, exactly where we were at in 2020. We did have to modify access, so we weren't able to allow drop-ins. We did provide phone and email support, and, you know, in all cases that I was able to manage, I would, you know, set appointments as soon as possible. But that did present some problems for clients who have limited means to be able to access phone or computer, or just limited ability to be able to keep an appointment. And isolation. I think this is something that everyone experienced, but, you know, in particular, a lot of the consumers that that I spoke with were challenged by isolation and didn't know how to access services, and service providers, while trying to support, were also experiencing that. So it was a wild year. Housing and homelessness continues to be a major threat. I feel the need to reproduce this slide, even though in my program, I found that people had more access to housing through the SIP hotels. But I do think it's important to recognize it as a human right, because what we have to understand is that when somebody is facing an eviction, they are being threatened with their life. The stress and the anxiety and the fear of getting a notice from your landlord affects people in a way that is tantamount sometimes to actually going through an eviction. And that presents itself in behaviorally in a lot of instances. And I did see a lot of that. I think HCAP did a really good job this year of trying to help clients resolve a lot of those disputes informally, avoiding litigation, avoiding whatever housing court looked like throughout 2020. But the last thing that any consumer needed to do was navigate that process. And hopefully it helped their health overall. But it begs, I think it begs some advocacy to say that appropriate safeguards need to be put in place to distance the housing service providers from the building management. Because in a lot of instances in the supportive housing environment, as funded as service providers, housing service providers can be, they don't necessarily have control over whether a notice for a failure to pay rent gets issued, or whether a notice of a violation of their lease gets issued. I see that Ken has his hand up, so that's unusual because this is the first time. So I'll just go ahead and take that question. But I can't hear you, Ken. I'm sorry.
Yeah, Stephen, I don't want to stop you, so I can wait till you finish.
Okay, that's okay. The mental health and substance use disorders continues to be, you know, the comorbidities that HCAP tends to see. Obviously, this presents issues that our entire service model sees. But HCAP tends to be one of the providers of last resort because there really is nowhere to go. I could find myself referring to psych emergency. what happens when a client is really, their behavior is so bad that, or their behavior is so challenging to manage that there is nowhere else to go. There's not a whole lot of places. And so we all have to be providers of last resort. And in a lot of instances that, conflict resolution is the only recourse. So aging with HIV and AIDS, we have, HCAP has seen that the community is aging along the same lines as most of the other presentations that I've seen. There's ongoing struggles with isolation, finding someone to be an executor of their estate, beneficiaries of their wills, and agents of powers of attorney. You know, not having someone in your life to be that can be really devastating. One of the interesting things that I saw this year was that the clients that I met with who experience isolation on a regular basis, they were particularly well situated to experience COVID in some ways. And I saw some, I heard some really beautiful stories of people, you know, managing against isolation, despite challenges in getting access to services and the service providers stepping up in response to that. That being said, not being able to access services is a challenge. And so, mental health, not having appropriate mental health support, and not being able to access computers to get onto telehealth appointments, those all were an issue. And then the disconnection from younger community members and service providers. I track most of those issues as cultural sensitivity issues, and you know, obviously advocate for trauma-informed care to combat it, and that continues to be the model that I follow. We had some successes in HCAP. There was an increase in mediations, 11 up from 7. If you remember last year, I kind of talked about how, you know, mediation comes in a lot of different forms. I am an advocate for mediation. I think it's an appropriate way to resolve issues in most instances. This year we had to do it telephonically and virtually in almost every instance. I fear that the days of me sitting down with a service provider and a consumer across from one another at a table are still far away from me, but we did have some strong resolutions, and oftentimes there was some guidance happened via email. There was one instance that's coming off the top of my head, but there was one instance where a client really didn't know how to take a meeting with their service provider without an advocate present. And so I guided them through email, asking questions alongside of them. Hey, I know this is what consumer, this was important to consumer. Maybe you can ask this, you know, questions that were already coming from the consumer, but not really feeling empowered to ask them themselves. And doing it and showing them how, giving them the tool to how to communicate to a service provider, in that instance at least, and in other instances as well, less poignant perhaps, but was very successful. There was a further decrease in grievances filed, 2 down from 7, which is significant. My feeling on grievances is that it should be more of a discussion and less of a complaint necessarily. I do think it opens up an opportunity for people to discuss how their services can be provided differently or better or more appropriately for a particular client. I also think it gives an opportunity for a consumer to voice their concerns and how they're feeling. And oftentimes it looks a lot like a mediation. So if I file a formal grievance, I think it takes on a slightly different tone. That being said, you know, I think this is, and this is my own take on it, but I do think that this is evident of a lot of empathy on the part of consumers to service providers, you know, that everyone kind of knew everybody was spiraling and everybody was trying to figure it out the best that they could through 2020. And if I think back to May 2020, you know, I was having conversations with clients saying, now might not be the best time to file a grievance because you don't know where a person is at. And it might not land very well. It might not land with somebody who has a sick mother or a sick child at home. And let's step back. How important is this? Is there another way to resolve this issue? Can we support in some other way? Or can we ask for a different thing that gets us to the same place, rather than file a grievance? And let's file a grievance. I want you to be voiced, but let's do it in a couple of months. And that's actually kind of what happened. We didn't file a whole lot of grievances until later in the year. And there were a couple of successes. So The first that I wanted to talk about was the medication delivery for people living with HIV during COVID. In this instance, there was a consumer that needed, that required medication. The client normally had medication mailed to them, which is typical. Although there were some reasonable there was a reasonable thought process behind not holding on to medication that was mailed to a building, it affected a large number of clients. And in this instance, one of the residents really required a reasonable accommodation be issued. So once I filed that reasonable accommodation, I tried, you know, resolving the dispute as you know, least adversarial, using the least adversarial method. And you know, that didn't go so well. The reasonable accommodation was then granted after asking for some support from our government partners, and that resulted in a DPH issued guidance requesting that certain buildings not require reasonable accommodation requests for medication delivery. One of the issues here that I think is important to stress for people living with HIV is that, you know, it's not having a medication that is the problem, you know, that is the problem. It's the fear that you're not going to have it, like not knowing whether you're going to get it tomorrow when you don't have a pill left. What does it matter? You know, I mean, that stress alone is incredibly traumatic. And for a client who has spent the last 30 years surviving by making sure they have their pills, that is an incredibly uprooting feeling to have, to not have control over it. And it came up in a number of instances and similar feelings in a number of ways this year. Another thing worth mentioning, I thought, was the sustained relationship of a consumer and an advocate in this instance. And, you know, I have a client that I was working with since I started at the program, and this client has had, you know, a number of issues, and I've reported on all of the issues, and the service provider has been responsive, but simply not having space to move a client to to an appropriate new unit, to relocate a client to a new unit. What is a service provider to do? Well, you know, our continued advocacy and our continued connection and the continued communication, a mediation more or less that lasted well over a year, resulted in finally finding this client a space that he is now thriving in. And that opportunity might have slipped away if I wasn't in, you know, a reasonably consistent mode of communication with the client and not contacting the service provider. And when it showed up, we were able to jump on it, and everybody was like, oh yeah this is perfect. And that's just kind of how it worked out, but that would not have otherwise happened if I wasn't in communication with the client and the service provider consistently. So I thought it was worth noting those two successes, because I think they were strong results for 2020. Here's my contact information. I will make sure everybody has it at any time. And I'll take any questions.
Go ahead, Ken. Unmute it.
Yeah, got it. So Stephen, thank you. The slides I felt were really helpful in coordination with the report itself. You know, it was almost like side by side. When I looked at it, I got a better clarification. A couple questions. I tried to form a kind of decision tree in my mind about, okay, 113 referrals, then those 113 referrals, if I'm correct, had about more than one contact per referrals. And then some of those went on to be referred to legal. Some of those went to mediation, and then some of those to filing grievance. So it's helpful to see that decision tree, and especially once you get down to mediation, how many of those mediations went to it's a legal referral, and how many, you know, why did we see such a drop from mediation to grievance would give me a better concept of all this. And I don't know if others find the same thing, but just trying to follow your decision tree on how this all works and how it goes from one to the other. The other would be helpful so much is of the 96 clients, are there some clients that have more than two grievances, you know, and so we get a sense of that, minor as that may be, just some sense of how that interplays. And lastly, the issue of age and access and understanding. Did you find any correlation between age and, you know, and as such, access to technology that you think will be improved or helped once we get back to face-to-face?
Sure. So I'll try to hit all of those in order. So the first question that you talked about as far as the continuum or some spectrum of issues, an important thing to remember is that HCAP, in the HCAP world, one consumer may have multiple issues going on. There may be multiple services provided for those issues. What you're talking about is more of a reporting issue than a practicality issue. It's not that someone moves from a referral to a mediation and then to a grievance if none of that works. That's not really how it works. Typically what happens is, you know, at an intake, I will speak with a client who doesn't really know what they need. They just know that they need mental health help, and they've been asking for it and they don't know how to get it, right? Well, have you been connected to mental health before, right? And so there's an informational interview that happens, an intake, right, where I'm trying to suss out how has this client been connected before, and then all of a sudden they'll say, oh yeah, well, I use so and so, and I'm like, oh, I know them. Would you mind signing a release and have a conversation? And then more information comes out, and then I have another phone call, right? And so it's not always clear at the outset of the intake how to categorize something. So there might be a disparity in what the issue, what an outsider might think of as the issue is, and what it ultimately winds up being. In very rarely is the issue really grievance worthy, where it requires like advocacy and like this needs to be voiced in order to affect change and tell somebody what, you know, oftentimes it's somebody is really, what really somebody is wanting is to be listened to. And I can help that happen without filing a grievance by mediating the issue. And so if I get on the phone and I talk with somebody and say, well, no, did you actually understand what the question was? Because this is what the question was, that kind of changes the issue from being a grievance to being like a miscommunication, something that I can resolve through conflict resolution. And so that might be some of where you're talking about. The other thing is sometimes clients do actually have multiple issues. In this instance, there weren't a whole lot of, in this last year, there weren't a whole lot of people who filed multiple issues. Although I do have some clients who have multiple, come in with multiple intakes and have multiple matters, which is why you'll see in the HCAP report that although there's only 96 consumers, there were 133 HCAP matters. And those are tracked separately. So for purposes of the report, Ken, I can probably do better about telling everyone what is the difference between what is a matter and what is an unduplicated client. I don't know if that would help clarify for you a little bit. The third thing, as far as the trend that you're seeing, I think it's important to note that, you know, my numbers are so small, right? I'm only one person. So I'm seeing 96 unduplicated clients. I'm seeing, a little over half of that as being over the age of 50. It's hard for me to spot a trend with regard to the technology issues that affect that population. However, I can tell you there was discussion in some of the other groups. You know, I attend other meetings and try to be as involved as I can. And a common issue that I saw and that I did see with clients as well was access to support for, you know, things that we wouldn't necessarily expect, right? Like a client who had a trust issue, who, you know, they had a trust, but the trust was being administered, but that information was coming to them electronically, and that person wasn't necessarily savvy enough to access the information that they needed in order to keep track of their finances. Is that something that necessarily that a money management service provider can help with? Not really. Is it something that a new computer would help with and that I could get funding for through emergency financial assistance? Also, not really. You know, it's more like I need a librarian to like go in and help that person. And so, you know, there were some moments where I was speaking with, you know, other service providers where I'm saying, wow, you know, this would be a really helpful thing to have. You know, who do we have, you know, that can support in issues like this, where it's somebody needs their handheld through a process or through a program or through a, you know, how to put a presentation on a thing. That's not a thing that we necessarily have in the service, the system of care. Did that answer your questions?
Sure. I mean, again, my questions are as much for insight that I feel like this committee is to give you on things that may make your presentation more clear. So, you know, it's just the decision tree of understanding, you know, why so many grievances didn't become, why so many mediations didn't become grievances as they have in the past. You know, where is that coming from? Because now you're doing X, Y, Z, and the decision tree would show that you're referring more to legal services or whatever that is. So we kind of get a sense of that. Thank you, though.
Yeah, thank you.
Any other questions? Well, go ahead, Mark.
In the early part of the slide deck, it showed the areas that challenges have come, included access, as well as just the need for information referral. Is there any framing that needs to happen about how COVID and the pandemic and sheltering in place might have impacted those two particular areas?
So there's a practical answer to that question, and then there's a reporting answer to that question, right? The practical aspect is I pick up the phone and try to figure it out. They mean two different things for reporting purposes. So an information referral I can frame it better, and I'll try to do so right now.
Oh, that wasn't a critique. That was just that might be of interest to folks to see if, yeah, that was not a critique.
Oh, okay.
It's like, you know, if you think that's part of the concerns that clients faced, you know, that the pandemic and sheltering in place actually did impact their need for access, I mean, their ability to access, then I just suggest adding that in. If not, then don't.
Got you. Okay. Access issues. So access issues like the one that I just mentioned to Ken, which, you know, were you know, access through virtual means, right? That is easily explainable by COVID-19. So not having a phone, not having a computer, or not having the funds to buy either of those, or simply not being able to use them, which is another common thing that I see. So that's what I would categorize as an access issue. The information and referral descriptors tend to refer more to warm referrals. So when I'm contacting a service provider, or if I'm helping a consumer through an application process to get emergency financial services or to get connected to mental health services, they're two different things. One would be me trying to support. The other one would be they have tried to connect, and for one reason, their disabilities have prevented them from being able to get in. So it might be helpful for the council to understand that difference. Yeah.
Yeah. What I'm trying to do basically is connect some of what I saw in your presentation to what is a part of the target for the needs assessment. You know, so the needs assessment target, as you're familiar with from the last community engagement committee meeting, does include some focus on access challenges. And so if there was a connection within your report to that upcoming assessment, then I just say, if it's there, make that point.
Jet after my report in the last community.
Oh, okay.
But thank you.
Go ahead, David.
I wasn't even there, so I'm not critiquing that either.
So I want to do a time check with Mark. How much time does Steven have for this?
Yeah, not much longer. You should give me probably about 10 minutes to go over the work plan, because I'm going to need suggestions from you all. It might go quick. It might not. So.
Well, no. Yeah, though that. But then also the reason why I'm asking is because I feel like for this annual report, we kind of have Stephen going all over the place for the amount of slides that he has. So I would rather that if it's going to be an annual report, if we want to have a certain focus to the annual report, better now so that we can sort of like support Stephen in that direction versus being like, what about your process? What about this? What about this? And I'm like, well, that's a lot. And I don't know how much time we have to cover that.
You make a good point. I don't necessarily want, because we're always on a tight schedule when it comes to these meetings these days. And so in some ways, like I think a quick and dirty on the actual process and focus more on the results is going to be important. Because, I mean, to be honest, like this is a report that people, not new council members, but that council members have been seeing every year delivered by a half dozen different people over the years. So in some ways, right, like the basic goals of HCAP should hopefully be well known by now. And so definitely less focus on those basic parameters of what the project is, and more on the stuff that you learned or the stuff that you want to portray to the council.
Right. And
plus,
feel
get
like
this in the event as well.
Yeah. And I think since we're going to be doing that needs assessment on sort of like consumer access during the pandemic, and either successes and challenges, I feel like that should be a like sort of like a direction or a general theme to focus on. So like you really discuss how, like, you know, talking about like we didn't file grievances because, you know, everybody's sort of turned upside down right now, and so let's roll with these punches until we figure out when's the proper time to submit that. And so I feel like those instances really color the numbers, you know, as well as sort of like giving us more of a clue of what consumers are actually going through this past like 13 months that highlight exactly where we should be going in terms of the council moving forward, and sort of like how we look at the services that we are, or not services, I'm sorry, at the needs assessment, but also the consumer access, making sure that those services are being responsive to the needs and strengths of folks accessing services.
So if I'm understanding correctly, some less focus on the overall, and I was trying something new with the screen and the thing, so it was hard for me to pay attention. But so I don't know. I tried to move through the HCAP kind of services pretty quickly, and then tried to focus on what exactly happened. If I'm hearing correctly, you're saying less focus on the HCAP services, like what, you know, the bare bones of what HCAP is, the definition of it, and move more towards the access issues and those issues that affect the council that they can act on.
Right, exactly.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah, and if anybody has questions about the bare bones basics, we can move those towards the end of the conversation. I think we really want to engage your expertise and your case studies about what exactly is going on, because that really tells us more of the detail of what exactly we're looking at over the past year, you know. Okay. And if people need to catch up with sort of the basics, we can do that afterwards. But I think, you know, we really want to get to your knowledge base quicker and faster during the presentation.
So if I could slightly disagree there, Dave, I mean, I understand your desire for a tight summary kind of thing, but I think we can't neglect the fact that people need a reminder on how it works. And I didn't see Stephen jumping all over the map, as you stated. What I saw is us giving him feedback about when he does present, maybe some ways to synthesize it, if you will, so we do get to the things you want. But if we don't do that, I think you're going to have a lot of questions from people who get off on tangents on one thing or the other. So it's a delicate balance here. And, you know,
I can be delicate.
Well, I'm trying to be delicate too, but I'm just saying, I don't want to, what am I saying? I don't want to redirect him totally from what he's already done, which I think was very good.
I think that I can address everyone's comments that I've heard today without too much effort. I also want to be upfront. There were some technological challenges that I had this morning that made me preparing for this a little bit more challenging. So if that wasn't too evident to you all, then I think I can do pretty good.
Yeah.
No, I think it was a great presentation. My thing is just, you know, you're hearing so much stuff and I'm like, just focus on what you have there. You know, it's great. I enjoyed it. It was good. It's good as is. I think it's more like, hey, how do we support you in really sort of highlighting, you know, the material and also your knowledge, because you have a lot of experiences with the individual consumers, and I feel that needs to be celebrated and also that needs to be highlighted, you know, in a way to being like, hey, you know what, this is what folks are going through, because, you know, we sit here in a little like socially distanced little thrones, and it's one of those things where like we really need to make sure that we're being responsive to the consumer need.
Well, if I can just affirm for a moment, you know, I as much empathy, I really do mean that when I say that there was a lot of empathy that was exercised by consumers. I think we all benefit from having a community of service providers. This isn't their first rodeo, and it was impressive for me to see, and that's something I intend to highlight at the end of the month as well, because.
Any other questions?
You're always good, Stephen.
Yeah.
You all are always good.
No, you are.
Right, I will let you all do your digestion. Unless you need me here for the...
No, get out of here.
Thank you all.
So what's new on the...
On the work plan. Okay, so I'm going to drop in chat some of the suggestions for presentation so you can all take a look at that. I'll read them, of course, as well. The suggestions were food security, housing, that's a pretty big topic, drug adherence in the homeless population, aging, another big topic, and COVID and transportation, pretty granular there. I'm going to, so consider those things. I'm going to pull up the work plan and you tell me if you feel any of those topics are, they're all real, but any of those topics have like such a potential impact on work and or need to be brought
to the fore of our understanding of the continuum of services. And then if so, then I'll try to add them here. There's definitely some room here I'm seeing. If folks feel like any of those topics, yeah, we need to drop that in here. So for example, the June meeting, I have not contacted anyone. So there could be some, there's some flexibility there. And in July, I don't know how people feel about having that, you know, that third one, which is a training. Like that had, the last training we had had some pretty mixed reactions. So I don't know if people want to keep that. So if people do feel that there's one or two things in here that they want to see in here, there is room for it. I see a hand raised by Ken Pierce. You're muted.
Am I there?
There you are.
Yeah.
And then Jack.
So the suggestions you gave us, COVID and transportation, later on in the year, like July, strike me as just, if nothing else, kind of preparation if we go through this again, and we have similar kinds of situations, and it would be helpful for us to kind of to take a look at what happened and what lessons we've learned and things like that, and if there is the time or ability or someone to do that kind of assessment or summarization for us. That's just a thought of the ones you gave us anyway.
Okay, thank you.
Does that make sense?
That makes sense, absolutely. Jack?
I guess I have two questions. One is, do any of these topics have like specific organizations attached, or like has anybody come to you and said, oh, we have a presentation about blah, 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 we'd really like to do.
I'll answer that right now. Nope.
Okay.
I would be reaching out to people that I know, or hopefully this group and or DPH would help me choose the appropriate parties.
Okay. And then my other question is, the training that was marked in July, was that just to say like, let's have some kind of training, or was there something already?
That was a part two to the training we received in November. So this committee last year narrowed the training topics down to two or three. The idea being, okay, we'll have the first one in November and we'll choose from the other two. It's been a minute, so I don't actually remember the other two for sometime this year. But the reaction to the training, some people did like it. Some others did not. And I'm not sure how it landed with folks. So as far as me pointing that out, that to me is just because there hasn't been a wave of people saying, this was such a good training, I want to do this more, that seems like a potential source for flexibility.
Yeah, I hear that. I think that they're all fine topics. I agree that like the topic of housing and aging are very big. I also don't know what we would be talking about in terms of housing, like a presentation on coordinated entry or like the shelter in place hotel situation or something like that. But
we're having a housing plan update this month. It's one of our three presentations. It's supposed to be a short one, even though it's on housing. Like 20 minutes, tops 15. So that's something. Yeah, that's housing and aging just seems so like both like super important, but super amorphous. So I find myself more attracted to the topics of food security / insecurity and drug adherence in the homeless population. Certainly drug adherence in the homeless population is something that I could maybe connect with. The long outstanding presentation that we've been trying to have from Deb Bourne and the mobile medical care, right? And food insecurity, I mean, that's what Project Open Hand specializes in. So that's a pretty easy go-to place. But I just want to see what you all think, like of what I mentioned, of what you see on that list. Is there anything that you feel like we need to have this scheduled for sure? Any energy around that?
I mean, I'd personally love to see a Deb Bourne street medicine presentation, just because I think they must have been doing like a bang up job this year. Do you know who is giving the housing plan update?
Manuel Vasquez.
From who, I think he's from where?
From, I think from he's from MOHCD, Mayor's Office of Housing and Community Development, I think. Irma's nodding her head, so yes.
Okay,
well then, if we're going to look at that, I mean, we already have mobile medical care on June. If folks, unless folks are objecting strongly, what I'm going to do then is maybe move mobile medical care over to July by replacing this topic there. How does that sound? And I know that when Deb originally was assigned to do this, she had a whole shebang going that she wanted to do. She wanted to bring in other providers. She wanted to bring in a client panel. She had a lot of stuff. This was pre-pandemic. So maybe post-pandemic, she'll have similar, not just bells and whistles, but like important information that will land in some ways, even to what Kent was saying, as far as future stuff that could happen. So if you want me to put that there, the other two things here are brief stuff, right? It's just, we go over that eligibility doc and then we have the carry forward allocation, if any. So if, unless I hear objections, I'm gonna start doing this right now. Okay, okay, there it is. It is now there. Sorry, training. If people want a training again on various woke topics, you just let the group know and we'll put them back in there. Absolutely. Okay, anything else in there? Anyone feel like there is a super strong need to see something about food or about anything else on that list? Or should we leave it as is?
I mean, do we have any, I mean, this is a strange question, but do we have any reason to believe that folks who are receiving RYMY Part A funded services are experiencing a lot of, like a significant amount of food insecurity?
I would say no. Okay. I'd say there's a lot of food.
Cause I'm like, if they are, then we should definitely be talking about it because we have a food provider, but.
Absolutely, absolutely. I mean, a food provider that's in many ways tapped out, right? I mean, that's really reliant on other sources of funding because they've had to restrict their parameters over the years. That said, I think Ryan White Part A folks are basically covered, maybe not in depth, but covered. It's the, you know, it's prevention folks and other people who are not necessarily part of the Ryan White care continuum, but maybe be seen as prevention consumers that there might be challenges with, but I'll be honest, I don't know. I just don't know. I know that this is a very resource rich city, but I also know it's had a substantial increase in our homeless population, and that's often connected to food. But you know, when you look at food insecurity, that's less around homeless, and that's more around fixed income, low income folks who may or may not have families or partners in place, and are resorting to patterns like hoarding or you know, things like that. So it's a complicated
issue. It can definitely be for homeless folks too. And I think it also can dovetail around housing conversations when folks, you know, are in SROs, sure. And they don't have the
ability to even store or cook food, right? Why don't we just keep it on our radar? I'll put this down here. I'm going to actually replace happen because we already saw happen. Good job, happen. That was a long presentation. Food security, insecurity. As just something for us to consider in case something else falls through and for next year, if that feels right for folks.
So Mark, it sounds like July, I mean, in another month or two, we may have a better sense. And it sounds like you may have some space to adapt July as we move forward if we need another presentation.
Yes and no. If the mobile medical care presentation is the kind that Deb previewed to me at this point a year and a half ago, that's going to be a full hour. So we might not want to schedule anything else besides these two things that we have to do per our mandate and then this. But there's other places, right? We don't need to have a Megatrends presentation. I'm sure Bill Bloom and Tracy Packer would be happy to not provide one. We don't need to have another Getting to Zero presentation. I have not contacted anyone. We haven't even talked about the trans one. So there's plenty of places.
Thank you.
Okay, and with that, I'm gonna close out because obviously we're 1 minute over. There we go, stop share. Thanks, folks.
All right.
Oh, that dog! Puppy. Yay, what a cutie.
Always good to see puppies. Oh, yes. Look at that. Right, yeah. How cute. All right. We'll see you on steering then.
Bye-bye.
Bye.